Well, I'm going to read from Genesis chapter 16. We're looking at life of Abraham, walking with God. And we come today to the birth of Ishmael. Now, Sarah, Abraham's wife, had borne him no children. But she had an Egyptian maidservant named Hagar. So she said to Abraham, "The Lord has kept me from having children, so go sleep with my maidservant. Perhaps I can build a family through her." Abraham agreed to what Sarah said. And so after Abraham had been living in Canaan for 10 years, Sarah, his wife, took her Egyptian maidservant Hagar and gave her to her husband to be his wife. He slept with Hagar and she conceived. When she knew that she was pregnant, she began to despise her mistress. And then Sarah said to Abraham, "Look, you're responsible for the wrong I'm suffering. I put my servant in your arms, and now that she knows that she's pregnant, she despises me. May the Lord judge between you and me." Abraham said, "Your servant is in your hands. Do with her whatever you think best." And then Sarah ill-treated Hagar, and so she fled from her. And the angel of the Lord found Hagar near a spring in the desert. It was the spring that is beside the road to Shur. And he said, "Hagar, servant of Sarah, where have you come from and where are you going?" "I'm running away from my mistress Sarah," she answered. Then the angel of the Lord told her, "Go back to your mistress and submit to her." And the angel added, "I will so increase your descendants that they will be too numerous to count." And the angel of the Lord also said to her, "You are now with child and you will have a son. And you will name him Ishmael, which means God hears, for the Lord has heard your misery. He will be a wild donkey of a man, his hand will be against everyone, and everyone's hand against him, and he will live in hostility towards all his brothers." She gave this name to the Lord who spoke to her. "You," she said, "are the God who sees me." For she said, "I've now seen the one who sees me." That is why the well was called Beer Lahairoi. And it's still there between Kadesh and Beret. And so Hagar bore Abraham a son, and Abraham gave the name Ishmael to the son she had born. Abraham was 86 years old when Hagar bore him Ishmael. Okay, there's nothing like a nice game of happy families, is there? And believe me, what is happening in Genesis chapter 16 is absolutely nothing at all like a nice game of happy families. In fact, it is a shocking, awful, dysfunctional mess. There's rivalry, there's jealousy, there's backbiting, there's division, there's cruelty, there's homelessness. You could go on and on through a list of things that are going desperately wrong here. In Genesis chapter 16, in the passage that we read, Abraham's family implodes. And you ask what's gone wrong. Now I want to suggest that there were one or two obvious answers that may not be the right ones. Obvious answers that we immediately sort of jump to. And I don't think they're quite what the story is here. First of all, an obvious answer is, well, what's wrong is that Abraham's action is immoral. He's being unfaithful to his wife Sarah. And of course that makes the whole thing sinful. And I want to be very clear about this, because if we did the same thing today, we would definitely be committing a sin, because God, as the Bible goes through, is absolutely clear about marriage being a total commitment of one man to one woman in love and total giving of ourselves. And there is a clear teaching also that says that not just adultery, but even the lust that could lead to adultery is sinful. So there are standards that the Bible sets out that say that what Abraham did in this occasion, we absolutely do not have the right to do in our lives today. So doing what Abraham did would be sinful for us, but he didn't know better. He had no reason to know better. He lived in a time and in a society where polygamy was totally accepted. There is nothing that God had said to him which said, "By the way, Abraham, you can't do this." If you want an instance of that, it's in Jacob, a couple of generations down the line. Jacob is the father of the 12 tribes of Israel. 12 sons who become the fathers of the 12 tribes. Jacob has two wives, Leah and Rachel. And he also sleeps with their servants, Bilhah and Zilpah. So there are four different women here. And the combined offspring of those four women become the founders of the 12 tribes of Israel. So it would not have been obvious to Abraham that God's promise could not be fulfilled through Hagar. Why ever not? The second thing that people might say about what Abraham did was that he was disobedient, because it wasn't God's plan that he would go beyond Sarah in seeking a son. And again, that's undoubtedly true, but there's no reason, no way that Abraham could have known that. If you look at God's promises to him, I will make you into a great nation and I will bless you. And then in chapter 13, he says, I will make your offspring like the dust of the earth, so that if anyone could count the dust, then your offspring can be counted. And again in chapter 15, where he says, this man Eliezer of Damascus, your servant, will not be your heir, but a son coming from your own body will be your heir. So that's what Abraham had to believe. There's everything there to say that God's promise would be fulfilled through Abraham's own son. There's nothing to say that it would have been through Sarah. So clearly, Abraham's action is not ideal, but is it an act of conscious disobedience to God? I think not. The third thing that Christians will sometimes say, and preachers say this about Abraham's action, is that it's wrong because it's an indication of unbelief. That what he should have done was simply to wait for God to fulfill his promise, but instead he had to take the bull by the horns and try and make it happen by himself. And he shows a lack of trust by trying to make things happen. He acted when he should have trusted. And you may have heard preachers preach along those sort of lines. And it sounds very, very spiritual, doesn't it? But for me, that sets up a false alternative, that either you trust in God for something, or you take action. And there are times when that choice is there. But most times, God wants us to do both. We trust the promise, and so we act on it. There's a good example of that in Acts chapter 27. Paul is in the middle of a sea voyage. He's being taken as a prisoner to Rome, and they get stuck in a storm. And it's the mother and father of all storms, and the ship is driven along. It lasts for day after day, and they don't see the sun for day after day. The mast comes down. The rigging is totally shot to pieces. The ship is disabled. They have to chuck all of the cargo overboard. Things are getting really desperate. People are despairing of their lives. And then God comes to Paul and he says, don't worry, because you're going to go to Rome, and actually I'm giving you the life of everybody on this ship. You do not need to worry, because I'm promising your safety. So what does Paul do? Sits back in his cabin and says, that's fine, God's promised it, we'll do nothing. No, he doesn't. What he does, he gets a number of necessary things done. He goes to everyone, he says, God's given me a promise. He's going to save us all, so you better start eating something, because you need your energy. We'll need to lighten the boat, so let's get rid of the tackle. We need to run it aground onto the beach when we get there. Cut loose the anchors. Those of you who can swim, you'll need to jump out and swim for it here. And the non-swimmers, grab bits of wood and jump into the water. There is no word of revelation that God gives to Paul for any one of those things. They're just the sensible things that you do if you believe the promise that God has given. And so action and faith go together. You trust and therefore you act. And most times that God gives us a promise, he's also giving us a kick in the pants and saying, get moving. Look back to Abraham. Abraham, at least before chapter 16, believes God's promises of a child. So what does he do? Well, what would you do? Do you sit down with Sarah and pray all night? I think not, you see. That's not how babies come. However spiritual you are, however much God has promised, that's not how babies come. You know, it isn't unscriptural and it isn't unspiritual to use our initiative as we respond to what God said to us. And on that basis, you can't criticize Abraham for trying to make what God had promised to him happen. It's not a lack of trust. So if Abraham is not immoral or disobedient or untrusting, something else is happening here. You have to ask, why is the outcome of chapter 16 such a mess? Now, I think the answer is because of the character and the choices of the three protagonists. There are three main characters here, and each one of them gets something really serious wrong. They make lousy choices that lead to a train crash of a family breakdown. And if you want to know how not to do relationships, this is a masterclass. The first character is Hagar. In verse 4, Hagar knew, when she knew that she was pregnant, she began to despise her mistress. She reacts with contempt. Now, Hagar doesn't need to react with contempt here. She could have reacted to her mistress Sarah with compassion and supportiveness. She could have allowed her son to be a source of consolation and encouragement to Sarah. The family could have been strengthened by her responding with grace in the face of Sarah's distress. And that isn't how she responded. She actually responds with a withering contempt, which says, oh, Sarah might be Abraham's wife, but she's a failure. She's failed as a woman. She's failed as a wife. She's a no-hoper. I'm going to, for the rest of my days, to rub it in for all that I'm worth. Heaven only knows why she felt that she needed to be vindictive towards Sarah. But that sows the seeds of more trouble than Hagar can imagine. It's easy even today to react to those who are in particular need with contempt. You look at the third world, hungry people, well, you know, it's their own fault. You meet people on the streets, homeless in Cardiff, you know, well, you know, no hopers. There is something in us that does that, and it's actually not helpful, it's not right, it's not biblical, it's not godly. Second character here is Sarah. And in verse 5 and verse 6, Sarah said to Abraham, you're responsible for the wrong I'm suffering. I put my servant in your arms, and now that she knows she's pregnant, she despises me. May the Lord judge between you and me. And Sarah ill-treated Hagar. She reacts with resentment rather than responsibility. She resents Hagar. And she resents Abraham. She says to her husband, it's your fault. Excuse me, whose idea was this? She ill-treats Hagar. Maybe deliberately she gives her the toughest and most demeaning jobs to do in a situation where Hagar is heavy and tired and hugely pregnant. Maybe there's some physical violence involved in here as well. Maybe it's just a load of very unpleasant verbals. I don't know, but Sarah makes sure that Hagar's life becomes an absolute utter misery. It's the attitude that says she's made me feel worthless and like rubbish, and I'm jolly well going to make sure that she feels the same way. So much so that, and this is hard to imagine, that Hagar, who is hugely pregnant, she has nowhere to go, she has no life outside of that family, nonetheless runs away. That's absolute desperation. She comes back. But then what about Ishmael? All through his childhood, he's living with the clash between these two women. There's the contempt that Hagar has towards Sarah. Every morning, noon and night, his mum dripping poison into his mind, into his ears, about the family that they serve. And then there's Sarah, and he sees his mother being treated badly. And then Isaac, when he's born, being the young prince and... you know, suddenly, he, Ishmael, is nothing. Good grief, you know, you can imagine growing up in a household like that. No wonder he ends up as he does. And when the angel says to Hagar, he's going to be a wild donkey of a man, his hand will be against everyone, and everyone's hand will be against him, and he'll live in hostility towards all his brothers, is actually, in a way, not a great word of revelation. How could he be otherwise? Of course he's going to be like that. I mean, this guy is the firstborn son. According to every tradition of the time, he should have been respected and looked up to. He should have had a place of honor in the family. He should have been someone really special. And instead, he's in the middle of a civil war where his mother's enemies hold all the trump cards and his enemies hold all the trump cards. And once Isaac is born, he's nobody. No wonder later on in chapter 21, in verse 8, you read that when Isaac grew and was weaned, and on the day that Isaac was weaned, Abraham held a great feast. But Sarah saw that the son whom Hagar the Egyptian had born to Abraham was mocking. Of course he is. Of course he is. What do you expect him to do in those circumstances? These choices have huge, great, big consequences. Well, you can understand, of course, some of Sarah's resentment here, but she also has got a choice because she can take responsibility for this situation that she herself has engineered. She can put her hands up and say, look, this has turned out really badly, but it was my mistake and it was my choice. And she can even lay down ground rules for Hagar and try and deal with this situation so that the sting is taken out of it. She does not do any of those things. In the pain that she feels, she fails to see beyond her own sense of hurt. It's everybody else's fault. It's everybody else's fault. The tragedy is, you see, that hurting people often become people who hurt others. And in a sense, that's not natural, but it's not inevitable. It's a choice that we make. It is a choice that we make. We feel got at, so we lash out. Have a rough day at the office, so we kick the cat. Shout at the kids. We feel dominated by somebody else, maybe a parent. And so we become people who dominate and bully others. We feel put down, so we become people who put other people down. And we learn the wrong things from our own suffering. Now, I'm going to suggest a political illustration here, and if this goes against your political understanding, then forgive me, but in the 1940s, the Jews suffered horrendously at the hands of the Nazis. The Nazis, as you know, tried to wipe them out in the Holocaust. Generations later, the Jews are in their own land where they hold the whip hand. They are now the powerful people in Israel. And there are vulnerable Palestinian people all around them. Now, I'm not blaming the Israelis for everything that happens in the Middle East because there's loads and loads of blame that can be spread all the way around there. What I'm suggesting is this, that they could have taken one of two lessons away from the Holocaust. One is the lesson that says, this must never happen again to anybody. And so we will never treat anyone remotely the way that we were treated. We will respect those who are now under our power. We must be compassionate. What they seem to have learned is the lesson, this must never happen again to us. Regardless of how we end up treating other people, we must be strong. And you see, the first of those attitudes heals relationships between generations, the second one perpetuates it. I want to say to you, if you're living with hurts, you've got a choice that you can make. Those hurts can make you bitter or they can make you better. They can breed resentment in your heart or they can give you an empathy and a compassion for other people. And that is your choice. It is your choice. And it is one of the most important choices you will ever make in your life. In fact, any time that we're hurting, especially if it's the result of the way that other people treat us, we've got that choice to make. We either take our pain to God, and we let Him heal, and we let Him soften our hearts, or we hold it to ourselves and we become hard. That, unfortunately, is what Sarah did. It brought untold and lasting damage. Well, the two awkward women, the third person here is Abraham. And you might be saying, well, it's not his fault, is it? Now, poor geezer, here he is. What's he done wrong? He's stuck in the middle of this huge, great civil war between angry women. Keep out of it. You know what? It nothing to do with him. Not his fault. And you see, I think that it is his fault. I think it is his fault. He's not guilty of contempt. He's not guilty of resentment. What he's guilty of is abdication. Because he is the leader here. He's a guy in responsibility. He's a responsible adult. And he is abdicated of responsibility. Between chapter 12 and chapter 16, he's a totally changed man. In chapter 12, he's saying to Sarah, now look, you pass yourself off as my sister. And if they end up thinking that they can walk off with you and have sex and whatever, that's fine. It doesn't bother me. And by chapter 16, he's saying, you know, whatever. Whatever you want to do, we'll do. Yes, dear. You'd like me to sleep with Hagar? Of course I will. I think I can manage that. And now you don't seem to be getting on too well with Hagar. You want her chucked out. Yeah, do what you like. She's your servant. Nothing to do with me. I'll step back from this. Abraham is in leadership in this situation, and he has totally given up. What he's doing is allowing the most troubled, and at this particular moment, the least balanced member of the family to call all the shots. That's a disaster. That is a catastrophe. When you allow the people who are least balanced, most troubled, most messed up to call the shots. It's a disaster in a family if it happens. It's a disaster in a business. It's a disaster in a church. And it can happen with a mild-mannered geezer in a family who will do anything for a quiet life, and he just steps back as wife and children fight each other. It can happen with a wife where the husband is aggressive and rides roughshod over the rest of the family, or dad abuses or is violent towards the children, and the wife's response is, I'll keep my head down. I'll do nothing. I'll say nothing. I'll just hope that it all washes over. You see, when we abdicate responsibility, we better expect the trouble to get worse. It happens in churches too. Perhaps it happens in churches even more because we're all Christians. And because we're all Christians, we think we should be nice and polite and easygoing and not rock the boat too much. And you don't know, that's... We had an instance in my previous church where I had some connection with a village congregation because my mate Phil was the pastor. And we didn't always deal with relationships very well, but we dealt with this one, I think, in the right way. And there was one guy in that place, the big personality clash, couldn't stand Phil for some reason or other. And there were a number of sort of clashes, but it culminated in a meeting that I happened to be at, a congregational meeting. And it was about something a little bit delicate. And in the middle of the meeting, this guy stands up, he shakes his fist, he points to Phil the pastor and says, it's all the fault of this man. You've got children there, you've got new Christians there. And this is a scene, it's dreadful really, and storms out. Afterwards, there are folks in the church who say, well, you know, he can't help it. Sometimes he happens, and, you know, this is a very important church family, and, you know, he's always been like that. And then as a leadership, when we get down and we say, what are we going to do about it? His wife collapses in tears at the prospect that there might be a confrontation. You can't do this. We decided to act. We decided to act. Why? Because the alternative is that if you do not give effective leadership yourself in a situation like that, you're effectively giving leadership to the least stable, the least mature, the least spiritual member of the church. You give them an absolute veto. It's a disaster. So two of us went to this guy calmly and with sympathy. We said, look, we know it's difficult. We know it's tough. But we have to tell you that if this keeps on happening, we're going to have to ask you not to come to those meetings. Do you know the guy's been great ever since? He's been great. The propaganda said, oh, he can never change, he can't help it, he's always been like it. It's almost as if he had been saying, please, somebody set a boundary. If you're involved in a situation that's being driven by driven people, you can write your own scenario, because it can happen 1,001 different ways in 1,001 different contexts. But let me say this, that as Christians, of course we're called to be people who respond to others with forgiveness and grace. We aren't called to roll over and die and fail to challenge things and people that are wrong. We are not called to do that. Jesus didn't do that. Paul didn't do that. The early church didn't do that. Unfortunately, on this occasion, Abraham did. He played the nice guy. He failed to challenge things that that were totally out of order. And the repercussions lasted for generations. And I believe, you know, there is an element of responsibility that God wants each of us to take for broken situations in our lives. It might be a family that's in a mess, or an individual relationship that's gone wrong. It might be an office where the atmosphere is absolutely rancid. And we aren't Superman, so we don't have to go charging and sorting everyone out. But we are God's men and women in the situations that he's put us in. And at the very least, we can pray for the people concerned, and we can ask the Lord, God, is there something that I should be doing? Is there something that I should stop doing? Is there something that I should say or stop saying that will actually make this situation better? We're called to take some responsibility. The results in Abraham's family are, well, they're disaster, they're dysfunction, division, distress. And they're patterns that are repeated in the lives of the next generation, Isaac and Rebekah, and the generation after that, Jacob and Rachel. It just keeps on going. Playing favorites, children who had rejected, the same pattern keeps coming over and over. That could have been hopeless, but it wasn't. There are two reasons why it wasn't. The first is because the God of grace, we have a God who loves us with a passion, and he never stops working for good, however deep the mess is in our lives. And in this situation, God protects Hagar and Ishmael. He blesses Abraham and Sarah. He never stops loving them, even when their lives are a total mess, when they've got just about everything that you can get wrong. And that God is our God. Romans chapter 8 and verse 28 says, in all things, God is at work for good for those who love him, who are called according to his purpose. In all things, through all the mess that we make in our lives, God never stops working for our good. He's still there. Lord, you never let go. The second reason why this isn't a hopeless situation is because a couple of generations down the line, this family finally learned the secret of forgiveness and healing. And it's Joseph through whom the lesson is learned. And you'll know the story of Joseph, most of you, that he's the 11th of the 12 brothers. He's resented by the older 10. He's sold into slavery. And having sold him into slavery, the brothers go back shedding crocodile tears to dad, saying, oh, unfortunately, our dear brother has been killed by a wild animal. One more angel in heaven, one more star in the sky, all the sort of schmaltzy kind of stuff. And it's all lies. It's all lies. And then Joseph spends years as a slave, many more years incarcerated in Pharaoh's prison. Finally, he's released, and decades after the original betrayal, after an absolute hellish nightmare, he's in a position of power, and his brothers turn up in Egypt begging for help. Three vital things happen there. First is that Joseph confronts his brothers. He engineers a situation where the whole family is brought together. The father and all of the brothers, and the unspeakable is spoken. And Joseph says, guys, I have to tell you, I'm Joseph. I look different, haven't seen me for 25 years, but I'm Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into slavery. And that's news to dad. Probably the first time that he's heard that. But he speaks out truth, not as an act of spite, but as a prelude to reconciliation. Truth is spoken. That is very important. Second important thing here is that there is repentance by the brothers. When the 12th brother, Benjamin, who is now the favourite, is in danger of being kept in Egypt as a slave, it's Judah, one of the older ones, who says at the end of chapter 44, "Please let me, your servant, remain here as your slave in place of this boy, and let the boy return with his brothers. How can I go back to my father if the boy isn't with me? No, don't let me see the misery that would come upon my father." And just underneath the surface of the words, he's saying, "We've done this once before, and it destroyed my father, and I cannot do it again. And I will take responsibility, even at the cost of my own freedom, to make sure that we don't." He's admitting fault. He's accepting blame. He's embracing a genuine turnaround. And that is immensely important, and it's immensely powerful. And the third thing, which is the most powerful thing of the lot here, is that Joseph forgives his brothers and he releases them from the prison of guilt that's held them incarcerated for 20 years. He's been in prison for most of those 20 years in physical prisons. They've been in a prison of their own, which is a prison of guilt. And now Joseph sets them free. He says, "Don't be distressed. Don't be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. It was not you who sent me here, but it was the Lord." You see, Joseph has carried the pain of his brother's betrayal, and now he freely forgives. And that's fantastic, because the family now is united after generations of division. That's what it takes. Confrontation with truth. Acceptance of responsibility and renouncing of what has been said and done wrong. And forgiveness, which is always offered at great cost to the giver, but is given freely to those who need it. There's something very special about Joseph. But it won't have escaped you that Joseph's act of reconciliation is a faint echo of something that would happen 2,000 years later, when the eternal Son of God carried the pain and the penalty for all the wrong that we've ever done. And he offered forgiveness at immeasurable cost to himself in brokenness and blood, but free, gratis and for nothing to every human being who's prepared to accept that. That is the glory of the gospel. And in the cross of Jesus Christ, there is this dynamic that gets right into the gristle of stuff that's gone wrong in our human brokenness and failure, in our relationships, in our families, most of all in our hearts, if we will let it. The Apostle Peter expresses it simply like this. He says, "He himself carried our sins in his body on the tree. Christ died for sins once for all to bring you to God." I suspect that God's wanting to say to us in a number of different situations, get real this morning. Maybe get real about situations we're in. Get real about the way that we're dealing with our past. Maybe get real about our own needs for God's forgiveness to flow into our lives, to deal with stuff that's there.